This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Andrew Cohen's new film, The Last Shift, asks us to look beyond the counter at the kind of place you've probably been to dozens of times, maybe hundreds in your life. A greasy fast food joint with a drive-thru, maybe some frozen custard, and workers making next to nothing. Cohen is best known for his documentary films. His work has turned up in ESPN's 30 for 30 series, on the Starz Network, PBS, and other places. When he was just getting started, he worked on Found magazine with Michigan's impresario of the unexpected, Davy Rothbart. The Last Shift is Andrew Cohen's first feature film. It premiered at this year's Sundance Film Festival. The story, which he also wrote, is about two men in Albion, Michigan, both at a crossroads, thrown together in circumstances neither of them wanted. Let's listen to a scene in which Javon, played by Shane Paul McGee, is in the restaurant's kitchen with Stanley, played by veteran character actor Richard Jenkins. Stan is training Javon to take over the night shift that he's held down for 40 years.
I don't know if it's these onions or the shit going down in Flint that's making me cry.
Well, why don't you try wearing gloves? It won't burn as bad. It's transferred mostly through the hands.
You know, the whole thing reeks of a failing autocracy.
Yeah, I know. So try putting on the gloves.
Let me ask you something. How much you make an hour?
$13.50.
After 38 f***ing years?
That ain't bad change.
Yeah, for a crossing guard.
Well, I start at $3.10.
$3.10? Damn, man, have you ever heard of inflation? My cousin manages at a Hardee's and makes $15.75 an hour, and she's like the least responsible person I know. Do you realize how much this place has profited off of your crotchety ass for the past 30-whatever years? They've literally made hundreds of thousands of dollars off your back. Did they ever share any of it with you?
No. What?
Yeah. See? See, man, that's what I'm saying, man.
The Last Shift premieres in theaters this week. Andrew Cohen joins us now. Andrew, welcome to Stateside.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So the film is about these two guys, Stan and Javon, who meet on the graveyard shift of a local fast food spot. The film has so much great texture, including the fact that this is not just a chain fast feeder. It's a locally owned spot that's been around forever. The kind you can find in so many towns in Michigan and across the Midwest. Was the setting important to you?
It was, yeah. You hit the nail right on the head. Yeah, you see these, you know, they probably serve frozen custard at some point. Yeah, you see these sort of mom and pop places, you know, scattered across Michigan. I was actually doing a guest lecture in Albion when I came up with the idea for the film. So yeah, you know, I have roots in Michigan, and yeah, the idea of doing something that was contained in one setting was really interesting to me. And, you know, I had this idea for this character of this fast food worker who loves his job and really takes it seriously and has this pride, which I found, you know, sad, but also kind of beautiful and funny and bittersweet in a lot of ways.
Do you ever work at a place like that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If I went down the list of crappy jobs I've worked, we'd be on talking here for a long time. Yeah. You know, I worked in fast food. You know, I grew up in Ann Arbor. I think my first job ever was at Burger King, worked at Subway. That world is not foreign to me. It's been a while, though.
Do you feel like you knew guys like Stan and Javon?
Absolutely. A few of the things from Javon, you know, obviously his is much more about the African-American experience. But, you know, I drew on some things in my own life. You know, I was quite a troublemaker at that age and was still really searching for my own path. And I think we all know people like Stanley. And I think, you know, what I was trying to do with this film is really explore the idea of white victimhood and the nuances of race and class, and hopefully do it in a way that adds comedy, because I think it's a great way to get to the truth.
You're an experienced director of documentaries, and The Last Shift is your first foray with a full-length fictional feature. What were some of the differences in the process, good or bad?
You know, I was actually surprised how well a lot of the experience I had making documentaries translated over to the narrative process. You know, I think one of your main jobs as a director is to really understand and be able to gauge a good performance from a bad performance. And I think being in the documentary field for so long and brushing up against real people and often seeing real people put it on for the camera, you know, really gave me a lot of tools to try and find that authenticity, you know, and to really reach deep to understand how people talk and how people bodies move. And just trying to bring that sense of realism to the work was important for me.
When you're making a documentary, I was interested in what you said about how sometimes people are putting it on for the camera. What's a way that you might try to get a subject to sort of be less aware of you and your crew and what you're doing, or just be a little more spontaneous and a little more true to themselves?
I always say that they should give away an Oscar every year for best performance in a documentary film. I think that your natural tendency is to act differently. I mean, even if I picked up a cell phone right now and started filming you, you know, you feel it. And so, you know, I would encounter that when I was doing documentaries and, you know, I got quite used to it. And I would just be frank with my subjects and say, you know, you don't need to tell me what you think I want to hear, or just pretend the cameras aren't here. A lot of times I would try and disappear, and that was, it's hard for me to disappear because I'm 6'5", but you know, I think that what you're really trying to do is just be a fly on the wall and observe, you know, observe humanity. And that can be tricky sometimes.
Did making a feature film let you exercise your inner control freak at all?
You know, interestingly enough, I had really great producers on this film. And one of the executive producers on the film is Alexander Payne, who's
right.
an incredible director. And
maker of Election and Citizen Ruth. And just
Citizen Ruth,
great,
Sideways,
great
yeah,
movies.
Descendants. He really took me under his wing. And we talked a lot about, you know, what kind of director do you want to be? And, you know, for me, I really took the approach that I didn't want to control everything. I sort of came to the conclusion that I was more interested in hiring really great people and surrounding myself with really talented people, you know, communicating my ideas, but then really empowering them to bring themselves to their work and elevate it to an unexpected place. And I would say that even with the actors too, you know, I wanted to be surprised, you know, I didn't want to hold on to a very rigid idea. And I think that for me, I think that's where great filmmaking can come, when it's truly collaborative. Because I have my little ideas and I can always fall back on those if I need to, but I'm more interested in how someone else interprets it.
What are some things that you experienced, or maybe that Alexander Payne might have shared with you about getting the actors to that place where they could sort of take over and that you wouldn't have to... I mean, not that she wouldn't have to direct, but like you say, they'd be free to explore what they wanted to explore in the story.
Well, casting is a big part of that. You know, I think that you always hear the term, okay, you know, 90% of directing is casting. And it sounds like lip service, but when you cast the right person and everybody's rowing in the same direction, trying to make the same film, it becomes much easier. You know, making your first movie sucks because you can't point to another film and just say, trust me, guys, I've done this before. Everyone's nervous, you know, of like, is this going to work out? Does this guy know what he's doing? I will say that Richard Jenkins, working with him on the film, I feel still to this day so lucky because he and I really connected. He's from the Midwest. He understood the film at its core. Again, we wanted to make the same movie. And I think once the rest of the crew and producers and investors all saw that we were on the same page, it really put people at ease. But, you know, one thing I learned is every actor needs to be directed differently. And I think that the great directors are really great listeners. Not that I'm a great director, but I have a lot of experience listening and doing documentaries. And I think all actors want is they want to know that you're paying attention, that you're watching their performances, and that you're keenly in tune with what they're doing, giving them space to make mistakes. You know, I remember Alexander would always tell me, you know, it's okay for an actor to make a mistake. Sometimes the mistakes are good, you know.
Did you know you were going to get Richard Jenkins for this project when you were writing the script?
No, I wrote the script after doing documentaries for about 10 years, I was getting a little exhausted. And I actually went to school for creative writing at Eastern Michigan and fancied myself a screenwriter for a while. I always used to joke that average screenwriters make great documentary filmmakers. But eventually I got tired of documentary and wanted to go back to the narrative world. And I wrote I wrote something very contained that I could just kind of make with me and my friends for a small amount of money. The script ended up in Alexander Payne's lap through various circumstances. He flirted with the idea of directing it, but he's the one that took it to Albert Berger and Ron Yerxa, who they produced Election and they produced Nebraska, Little Miss Sunshine. And after that, we were off and running. And Richard Jenkins, you know, I was always a huge fan of his. I always thought that he would be perfect. He was always my first choice. I rewatched The Visitor and I just thought, this is the guy. And to his agent's credit, you know, we sent it to him. She read it. She loved it. She's actually happens to be from Michigan, Richard Jenkins' agent. Mm-hmm. And he read it the next day. And 3 days later, we were on the phone and he just said, I love this script. You know, I want to do it.
And we should say that The Visitor is a film that Richard Jenkins made in, I want to say the mid-2000s, about a professor who's sort of working his way through a pretty lonely life. And again, it takes place in Michigan.
He was nominated for an Oscar for that and also for The Shape of Water.
So a lot of your documentaries have focused on stories about America's working poor, people who are just trying to get by and are just barely getting by when they're getting by at all. And that's the case in The Last Shift, too. Richard Jenkins plays this fry cook, Stan, who's been in the same job at the same, you know, hometown joint for almost 40 years. And Javon, who's coming to take on the shift that Stan is leaving, is this kid with a really great brain, but it seems like nobody in his life thinks he's going to be able to get himself together. What draws you to people in these kinds of circumstances in your documentaries and for this film?
I don't know. You know, I guess those are just the people I identify with, I think. You know, I was raised in a middle-class family, and, you know, I always just, those are the stories that I like watching. And I think ultimately you're making a movie kind of for yourself, you know, like, I'd like to watch this. I don't know. I guess I've always really been into like Americana and stories about America and the kind of textures in America and the complexities of America and the contradictions of America. I think it's such a fertile ground, especially the time we're in now. And I think I just kind of wear it as a badge of honor being from the Midwest. I feel like that part of the country is so misunderstood. And I think that, you know, every 4 years, people try to understand it whenever there's an election of like, what's going on in the heartland of America? And then they go away. So I think for me, it's about making sure that Midwesterns are being represented on screen, because I think I see a lot of films about the Midwest that are for people from the coasts. And my whole thing is I wanted to make movies about people in the Midwest that people there can watch and laugh at themselves. And I think going back to Alexander's work, he's so great at that. You know, mm-hmm. his films, Nebraska, or, you know, they are from this place and he's from this place and they're about this place, but people that are from there can also enjoy them. And I think ultimately we go to the movies to see a piece of ourselves. And that's something I take pride in.
If you're just joining us today, my guest is Andrew Cohn. He's the director of several documentary films, and his new feature, The Last Shift, is premiering this week in theaters. The Albion in the movie is pretty much like Albion. It's a former factory town that's had better days. And the times have not been particularly kind either to Stan, you know, someone of his generation, or Javon, who's sort of on the other end of what was Albion's prosperity. And there's not a small amount of racial tension between them. They both have had some knocks in their life, but at the same time, Stan does some things in the film that are kind of hard to defend. You mentioned the fact that you wanted to explore white victimhood in this film. What was it you were trying to get at? Did you want people to feel sorry for Stan?
No, absolutely not. I think what I was interested in is showing the complacency of white America in terms of race. And that I think a lot of people think of racism as these people wielding torches or, you know, cops beating up unarmed black men. But in reality, there's an underlining, I would say one of the reasons that we are where we are in terms of race relations is white America's inability to do anything. and I wouldn't say all of white America, but some of white America, to sit back and be complacent while these things happen. And it's not that, you know, Stanley's done some horrible things. And I think that that's, you know, I always love protagonists that are really complex, you know, and they're broken and do terrible things. And we try to find the humanity in them despite that. But, you know, at the end of the film, Stanley is left bankrupt morally, you know, literally. And so, you know, at the end of the film, I think it's quite tragic what happens to him. So I'm not so much looking to have people empathize with this character, but more to understand where the circumstances in which somebody could find this worldview.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Stan's a guy who would have said, and I think does say in the film, that he has no white privilege.
Right.
But he ends up exerting privilege in, I guess, the only way a practically homeless man in his late 60s, early 70s can.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think Richard brought such a humanity to the character also, and an edge to it all, you know, but ultimately I wanted to point the finger at like the absurdity of people who don't understand white privilege. And like I said, the complacency of white America's inability. It's not that he's done awful things, you know, but he sat back and watched awful things and did nothing. And that at the end of the movie, he does nothing when faced with a hard choice. I think that that's, you know, unfortunately reflected in some of where we are in 2020.
Did you draw at all on things that you saw and learned in your documentary work in how you were directing Richard Jenkins and Shane McGee, your leads for this?
Yeah, you know, I'm always drawing more on my life experiences and just knowing these people. Richard had a take on the character that I thought was really smart, and I kind of wanted to let him run with it, you know, and Shane, you know, who's an incredible actor and came in and, I mean, he won that role and beat out a lot of great actors for that role. You know, watching him and Richard work together was phenomenal, and Richard taking him under his wing and showing him, you know, to go toe-to-toe with Richard Jenkins is no small feat. And a lot of critics have pointed to Shane's performance as a real highlight in the film. And I take real pride in that, you know, of getting great performances out of my actors. But, you know, film sets are odd. It's, you know, you walk in and you think of, you know, filmmaking and directing as art, but you're really walking onto a construction set.
Yeah.
It's insane. And there's hundreds of people running around and banging and, you know, makeup and trucks everywhere. But in the middle of it is this really magical thing happening between the camera, the actor, and the director. And Alexander always taught me you have to protect that. And so what I was constantly trying to do when I was directing was to make sure the actors knew that they were the only people here that were important, and really protecting that and all the madness from all the madness that's going around it. And so, you know, I wanted that space to be intimate and to be protected and to not be infringed upon. And so, you know, I think one of your main jobs as a director is being a leader, you know, but also setting the tone in terms of the set. And I took pride in protecting that space for the actors so that they could, you know, feel free to make mistakes. You only need one good take, you know.
Right. The film premiered at Sundance 2020, which I think will go down in memory as the weirdest Sundance to date, given what's happening with the pandemic and the climate for filmmakers during the pandemic. Tell us a little bit about how the film's distribution played out and just how you felt when you realized what was going to be going on this year at the time when you were pushing this important project out.
Well, I was joking with somebody the other day that they should have printed t-shirts that said Sundance 2020, the last film festival ever. because that's sort of what it feels like now, unfortunately. And, you know, my heart breaks for the filmmakers who were going to have premieres later that year, you know, Tribeca and South by Southwest and the rest of the fall festivals.
Which just completely went online, if they were held at all.
Went completely online. I mean, to me, I try to have perspective. At least I'm not in the restaurant industry. You know, I have a roof over my head. And so, you know, my problems pale in comparison to others. You know, it was a weird time. I mean, Sundance happened. We had a few offers, but nothing we wanted to jump on. A pandemic happened. I think distributors were all trying to figure out what was going on. At first, it was kind of denial of like, okay, this, we're going to be shut down for a few weeks. Then I think there was sort of an attitude of, okay, well, let's just wait this out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, they had to come to terms with reality, which was that this is not going away. We can't just curl up in a ball. And so people were trying to figure out what to do. And Sony came along and were a fan of the film and felt like it was timely and at its core understood it and were a fan of, you know, Richard's performance. And, you know, it's a very odd time to be putting out a movie. It's definitely not lost on me. I mean, even promoting the film feels, you know, a bit surreal trying to pull people into a theaters, you know, during a pandemic. And
it's impossible.
Yeah, exactly. I don't really particularly want to go to a movie theater. And I do think theaters have done a pretty poor job in explaining the safety. You know, it's certainly probably more safe to go see a movie than to go out to dinner, which people are seem to be doing. I don't think there's been a single case that anyone's gotten from a movie theater. But, you know, we can't just roll over and die. We have to keep creating. We have to keep pushing. And, you know, hopefully people can connect with the film and watch with the film or watch it when it comes out on VOD.
The Last Shift takes place a couple of years ago. I want to say like 2015.
You know, it's somewhere in the present. Yeah.
Sure. And it's kind of impossible in 2020 to watch it without thinking of where these two guys would be right now. They're at such a crossroads. And this is such a crossroads time for a lot of people, especially people, you know, who might have made their living working in greasy spoon diners and fast food joints. Do you think much of where they would have found themselves after the events of the film?
I always felt like when I was writing the movie, the end of the movie was the beginning of Javon's story. In a lot of weird ways, he's sort of starting to find his path. And you can imagine the great things that he's going to go on and do. And the tragedy, I think, in Stanley's story is he's probably going to be right where he is, you know, until the day he dies. And yeah, these characters, they grow on you. And so, you know, I would hope that Stanley would find some reckoning. And I think, I don't want to give away the ending. And at the end, I think he does come to some realization. But there's, you know, bittersweetness to it. I'm not quite sure that he fully grasps the darker sides of his instincts and fully understands the weight of his words. And so I'm not sure if he fully comes to a reckoning or not. I'll leave the audience to decide.
Andrew, thank you so much for talking to us about this, and thanks for the great film.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Andrew Cohn wrote and directed the new film, The Last Shift, and it's being released this week by Sony Pictures. Sadly, no screenings in Michigan right now, but watch for it on demand later this year. Arts and culture coverage on Stateside is supported in part by an award from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.